I'm cursed, I'm an addict.
I'm cursed.
Can you hear me over at the back?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, okay. I'm sat here and I've got sweaty palms and I all of a sudden feel like a very little fish in a big pond. I just want to say thank you for, you know, asking me to come and speak. The longer I've been around, the more I understand the responsibility of speaking in NA. And, you know, just before I started, I kind of tried to connect to a higher power and ask that I say something that's of use to someone in this room tonight. And if that is a newcomer, that's amazing. You know, my experience, strength and hope. I talk about my childhood a lot when I share, because there's a part in our step working guide where it talks about where the seeds of addiction were planted. And in hindsight, I came to understand that all of those things are relevant. They're not what make me an addict, but they are what bred, you know, the seeds, where the seeds were planted, and they went on to take root later. And that's why I talk about my childhood, because it is relevant. But if you didn't go through the specific things I went through, it's okay. That's not what qualifies me to be here. What qualifies me to be here is that I identify myself as having the disease of addiction, and I understand that I'm powerless over that disease. I was one of the people. I grew up in a family of addicts, you know, kind of like Kieran said. Both my parents were addicts, and so, like, everything I ever learned about the world, I learned in a really dysfunctional way. So I learned that I needed to be my own God, that if I ever wanted a need met, I had to meet it myself, that people lied, that they said one thing and did another, and that, you know, when I kind of got into school and stuff like that, I learned that I hadn't been taught a lot of the basics. You know that feeling we sometimes have here of never getting the guidebook to life? I felt like that. I massively felt like that in school when other girls, like, knew how to do their hair, or even little things like, we didn't brush our teeth in my house. We didn't. It just wasn't a thing. You know, we didn't worry about changing underwear or things like that. That wasn't a thing either. And so everything that was dysfunctional about my life, I learned through comparison. I learned through looking at other people and thinking, like, how does she look neater than me? I don't understand that. I must get up and do the same things that she does every morning, right? And I very quickly came to learn that these people, these parents' people, they possibly weren't doing their job. And so if that job was going to get done, I was going to have to do it. You know, and that's just the practical side to things. If we look at the emotional side to things, you know, the reality of being the child in an addicted household is that, you know, there's always this thing that comes first, and the goalposts always change. And this thing, this invisible, intangible thing, matters more than you do, even though you didn't do anything wrong. Which is it's a bit of a bitter pill to swallow, that, like, it didn't matter how good I was or how helpful I was or how well behaved I was. It was never good enough. It was never just good enough to penetrate through the gouge. Never once. I couldn't perform enough. I couldn't be fabulous enough. I couldn't be funny enough. I couldn't be witty enough. I couldn't, you know, bring a good enough certificate home from school to penetrate through the gouge. And so, like, emotionally, what that did was it kind of bred just a disconnection. It bred a disconnection with people in general. And you know, it was only so long before, you know, social services became aware of the situation. And everything I know about my childhood, I know through reading my social services files not too long back. Like, most of this, I don't remember. I don't remember a social worker coming and finding me in a pram left out in the rain whilst my mum... I don't remember that. I don't remember those things. But I remember being able to walk into a room and read a vibe immediately, because how they responded to me was crucial, you know. And if I didn't pick up very quickly on what happened, I would probably do the wrong thing and end up getting hurt. And that's something, interestingly, I've carried right the way through my life. You know, so I I ended up in foster placements, and I was young enough that they were trying to implant me into another family to breed connection. But what they never told these other people was that I was already lost. I was already lost. Like, that switch had already been flicked, and I didn't even know. And again, this is about... So you can imagine when the disease of addiction grips hold of something like that, it's like a playground for this disease. You know, and these families, they look through these brochures at kids, and there's me and there's my little brother, and you know, they put me in this family with this woman, and what she wanted was a little girl who she could put bows in her hair and were pretty. I was broken. Fuck bows. I don't want bows. I don't want dresses. I just want to, like, understand how to get through life. I just want to wake up and just feel like the next kid in the playground for one day. You know, and they put all the material things into place. They took us to Disneyland, America. We had the whole, you know, kit and caboodle, the clothes, the everything. And that's when I realised that there was something internally wrong. Because even with the Disneyland, the cars, the houses and all of that stuff, I still felt like the council estate addict's kid. I still felt like that inside. And, you know, and in that foster placement, that's where, you know, there were six foster kids and this kind of mum and dad. And some of the boys, they were older. There was one at 18 and one at 16. And then between them two and the foster dad, they all, independently of each other, were sexually abusing me over the years that I was there. Now, I already didn't need a reason to kind of shut down from life. But what that did was whatever... It makes me emotional just thinking about it. Whatever that bit of spark, that bit of fight was that had kept me going for that long, it just extinguished it. It just completely extinguished it. And I just retreated even... I didn't want to be part of this world. I didn't want to know people. I didn't... Even my own body wasn't mine, let alone anything else, you know, family and all of that stuff. None of that was for me. And then even my own body wasn't mine. And... again, just once the disease of addiction grips hold of something like that, that just devastation, internal, emotional devastation is what is born. And, you know, I ended up back in the care system because I eventually, like, I stayed with the deluded belief system that if my brother would be okay if I stayed. I didn't want to mess up his placement. And that was, you know, that was the distortion that kept me there for as long as it did. And in the end, I kind of snapped and I went into the care system. And that, for me, it was sweet relief. Nobody could hit me. Nobody could hurt me. Nobody could tell me what to do. The worst thing they did if I ran away was phone the police. That was it. It was great. Because I lost the semblance of accountability, so I stopped pretending to be accountable in life. I stopped pretending to try and live by the same guidebook that everybody else did. I didn't care anymore. I didn't care anymore. You know, and what substances did for me, you know, I don't believe they ever took away my feelings, but they did just quiet the voice. The voice that goes, you deserved it all. You were somehow bred for this. Everything that's ever happened to you, you're responsible for. It just dulled down that voice, you know, and so I didn't understand what it meant to have the disease of addiction at that time. So I just knew that I was like a go hard or go home kind of person. Do you know what I mean? And I wanted the most, the best, the fastest way possible to ingest it. And I wanted to take the most concoctions and still be standing and things like that. You know, I didn't understand what that meant. I just thought I was like, cool. That's what I thought. And you know, and the reality, like when I look back here, the realities are that I used to take drugs like trips, right? And I'm a vibes watcher. Remember this, right? So if you take a trip and have a bad trip and you're a vibes watcher, your life is... I used to run home back to the children's home, lock myself in a room and write things down and scare myself in the mirror. That was the reality of it. Do you know what I mean? I used to pull funny faces in the mirror and actually scare myself. It wasn't quite the wonderful, funky, cool, you know, spiritual experience it should have been. It was horrible. I was paranoid. And And it was devastating. And I used to run away and lock myself into a room and try and not let the staff at the home know that there was anything wrong. The reality is no one really cared. My mates didn't care. The staff didn't care. I didn't care. No one cared. And what, you know, what happened is they brought, like, my dad started to look for me, and I hadn't seen my dad for about 10 years at that point. And, you know, I remember meeting him again, and, like, I walked into this room in this social services office, and he looked like Skeletor. He looked like I did about 20 years later, 10 years later, whatever it was. And the reality is at that time, I couldn't even have a relationship with him, because what he had was access to things like Tamazi eggs, which my mates, we didn't get things like that at that age, do you know what I mean? And I used him for that. That's the reality. I ended up with a shed load of Tamazi eggs and a pair of green Nike Air Max. And then I didn't go there one night when I was supposed to, and I got a call the next morning to say that he'd died. And I'd only known him for 10 months. And it's just another one in a long line of, there's no words for what that is, but just that's those kind of things are where, like, despair was born in my life, and just took an absolute grip of my heart. Like, what's the point? You know, the only solace I ever found was in substances. And the substances, whichever they are, is kind of irrelevant. I just found some solace there, and I think I could pretend to be connected to other people and behave like other people did and think like other people did. And my using story is not special or wonderful by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I got into what I got into. I wanted it in my body in the fastest way possible, and I really didn't care about the physical consequences of that at all. I didn't care about the situations that I ended up in, the people that I was around, or the things that I had to do. And I remember getting sent down for the first time at 18 years old. I got sent to HMP Risley, which was a mixed prison at that time. And, I was a little YO, and it was like 3 weeks before Christmas. And I got a two-week remand, and I'm sat on this sweatbox, and we're driving through the city that I'm from. And I just remember seeing people doing Christmas shopping and just living these normal lives. And that was the story of my life on the inside looking out, just unable to be a part of that. I never ever thought I would ever get to be a part of that, ever, you know. And I went in and I did that sentence, and they let me out after 2 weeks, and it was, in a way, it was the worst thing that could have happened, because what I realised was that society's worst consequence for me was cool with me. I learned that I'm a chameleon. I learned that I'm a survivor. I learned that having a big gob is sometimes really helpful, because I can talk my way into and out of any situation that comes my way. We're far from daft here. We're far from daft. And basically what that spiralled into then was lots of different ways and means to get more. And there was no line. There was no line I wouldn't cross. And the reality is, the stone cold I don't dress up my addiction. The stone cold reality is this: I ended up on a street corner in Blackburn. It's like middle of winter, blood clot on my lung, so every breath I took it felt like I was getting stabbed in the lung. Next to nothing on, freezing cold, and something hit me, something penetrated through that despair. And I wanted to be anywhere else under the sun than where I was. But I had no power to move. No power. And what I did was just do the next punter, go and do the next fix, and keep it moving. Those moments of clarity didn't last long. They didn't last long at all. I never knew a way out. I never knew a way out. You know, my dad had died from addiction. My mum had been gone for about 10 years at that point, and there was nothing for me. There was just nothing. Prison provided me with a respite every so often, and I would come out. I would go back to the same, crack houses, but they were my houses. And I got sent some pictures once, like a council repossessed one of my flats, and I got sent some pictures once, and you know, like in your head when you think you live in a bit of a palace, and then you see these pictures and realise that it was an absolute shithole. Like, excuse my French. They sent me these pictures, and like I thought it was really cool because we had carpet, but the carpet didn't go to the edges of the wall. It just kind of ended in the middle of the room. And like I was really proud because I'd used some of the money that I'd sex worked to gain to buy paint, but the paint ran out before I painted to the end of the walls. And you know, that it was a mess, and like seeing that, like I felt ashamed. I felt ashamed that I'd somehow, after vowing to myself I would never become like them two cretins who brought me into this world, I'd somehow become them. How the hell did that happen? This was not in the plan. It's not what I wanted. I despised. I cannot tell you the depth and the breadth of hatred I had for my mother. For some reason, it didn't extend to my dad, even though he was exactly the same. But I despised her. And I kind of realised I'd become her. But again, I had no way out. I had no knowledge that there was anything else. I didn't know. I had no idea. So I just kept doing what I was doing. And at one point, I remember resigning myself. Do you remember them conversations before? If you've ever been in prison, before you get released, there's those conversations that go, I know what I'm doing with a discharge grant. I'm going to go out. I'm going to get smashed. It's going to be amazing. Like, I was one of them. I didn't even try and kid myself, because there's this really weird thing that happens on the day of release. Like, I'd done it before. I'm not doing it this time. I'm going to get out. I'm going to get clean. Things are going to be different. From the landing to the gate, when you walk, something mental happens. And the three... Whose idea was that? Why? I'm just going to have a drink. That's what I'm going to do. You know, and in the end, I got released on my last sentence, and... my last but one, sorry, and I thought, right, I know what's... Preston's the problem, that's where I'm from. Preston's... got to get out of Preston. I'm being oppressed in Preston, it's awful. The addicts there, I mean, they're just gutter addicts. They're awful, I just need to get out. I'm going to go to Manchester, that's what I'm going to do. And when I get to Manchester, I am not going to use that particular drug in that particular way. I'm not going to do it. So I'm going to throw this other thing up my nose instead... And it's all going to be amazing. And within 2 weeks, I was back with serving the license from that couple of years with another 3.5. And what happened in that 2 weeks fundamentally transformed my life. I'm more of a fraudster type criminal, blagger, than a in your face kind of. I'd do it when you weren't looking rather than do it to your face. And I'd ended up committing a couple of robberies, and. One of these robberies, it was on a train station in Manchester, and I hadn't noticed that this woman had two children with her, and those two children came running round the corner as I'm in front of this woman with a knife trying to get her handbag. Now, the little boy, and there's no, you know, there's no shame when I say this anymore. I've kind of worked through that, but I share it because there are those things that we've done that we don't want anyone to know. And if there's anyone in here who's done that, like, me too. This little boy, this four-year-old boy, is stood in front of me crying, saying, please don't hurt my mummy, please don't hurt my mummy, please don't hurt my mummy. You know, and I always say, I would love to be able to say, like, you know, God came through the clouds and I had a moment of clarity and what am I doing? And walked away. And I'm an addict. It wasn't like that. You know, no power. Purse fell out of her bag. I grabbed it and ran. But what happened was this, that little boy haunted me. So when I went into prison for that, his face wouldn't leave me. His face wouldn't leave me, his words wouldn't leave me. And finally I'd done something that wasn't all right by me. Finally, like years later, and I'd done lots of things over the years, but that wasn't all right by me. And you know, I carried on using for another year because I'd done the prison programs and enhanced thinking skills, and I passed those things with flying colours, but they don't stop me using. They don't. They just teach me how to communicate better. That's it. You know, I did lots of different things, and I don't know what I was searching for. I've no idea, but I know that I didn't find it. And then I had a conversation one day with a drugs worker, and she gave me two choices. And you know when you look back and realise that you're at a crossroads moment in life, but you didn't know it at the time? She offered me two prisons to go to, one down south and another one up north that was full of that stuff I was throwing up my nose. And for the first time in my life, I made the right decision. You know, and it was like, it weren't deep and profound, and I wasn't coming down here to seek enlightenment or anything like that. Like, on the weather reports, it was always warmer down south. That's why I was coming. I'd told all the lies. I'd been found out a million times. I'd kind of exhausted all my options up there, and at least I would have some new people to blag. And I had no idea what I was walking into. Like, I remember, I'll never forget being on the sweatbox travelling down, and I remember looking out of the window of this sweatbox and just thinking, like, for the first time in my life, I'm doing the right thing. Like, I can't tell you what that meant in that moment, because after so many years of doing the wrong thing, getting it wrong, messing it up, failing again, like, to actually connect and feel like I was doing the right thing was massive. You know, and I walked onto this unit at this place where they did these 12-step things, and I met these people that spoke this really interesting language. And I had an argument with somebody who tried to tell me I was insane, because I'm clearly not insane. You know, and I thought she was just being leery. I thought she was really leery and quite rude. And the reality was that, yeah, that was kind of me. That, yeah, I did get up every single day for the last 10 years, knowing it was not going to be any different, and telling myself it was. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And I bought it. I really believed it. And it took about half an hour for that process to occur as well. Yeah, today's going to be different. It is, of course it is. It's sunny outside. It's going to be wonderful. And it never was. It never was. But, like, we're so tenacious. It's unbelievable. Like, we have the survival skills that we have they're just second to none. You know, how do you do that? How do you continue on year in, year out with, like, zero hope and zero promise of change and somehow remain optimistic about the whole thing? You know, we're quite amazing, really, aren't we? And that's where I was introduced to the life-saving message of Narcotics Anonymous. And the wonder of that has never left me, because for someone like me, like being on that street corner, do you know what I mean, with another fucking stranger's bits and bobs in my mouth for some paltry fucking amount, and I don't sit in here and lie, I don't, you know how we come in and we go, yeah, yeah, it was 50 quid every time. If I needed £3.75, that's what I sold my soul for. That's the reality of my addiction, and I will not stand it. Like, I won't sit here and dress it up, because I'll die if I do. Because that's what this illness wants me to do. It wants me to come in here like I'm something I'm not. And the reality is this: I am a gutter using addict. Fact. Well, I am, but I don't live like that today. So I come here and I hear that I never have to use again, no matter what. Now, that was like, that was a bit of a stretch at that time. It was a bit of a push. But I never saw the seed of hope being planted. I never saw it coming. And like, they had this little meeting every Wednesday where they gave, like, these things out. And I don't know why, but I thought that was kind of cool and I wanted one. And I got one. After I missed that one because I lied when I got there. But I remember getting this, and I remember what that meant to me, like, 30 days clean. Maybe this can work for me. Maybe I don't ever have to go and sell myself again. Maybe. You know, and then being the addict that I am, I took it to the other extreme. So then I became a warrior for NA. So help you God if you didn't do this stuff and do it wholeheartedly, because you were going to die, you know. You know, as we do, and I became sanctimonious and self-righteous, and I thought I knew everything about everything, and, you know, and I was rigorously honest, so I was going to be okay, and if you don't get honest, I'm going to tell on you anyway. I was one of them. Bearing in mind, I'm still in prison at this time, so I haven't experienced the realities of recovery with like, physical freedom. I had, you know, I thought I had it on lock, so I was good. And, you know, and I got released from prison on my 1 year clean day. And I went to another treatment centre. I became fully aware that there was a lot more work to do for me. And what happened just before I left, I searched for my mum. You know, that, like, you sit in enough meetings and hear enough people talk about, my mum said she was proud of me today, my dad said he was proud of me today, and that little dream was born in me. I wanted that. I wanted to belong to someone. Like, it was enough to belong to you guys, don't get me wrong. It filled that gap, but I wanted a parent. Like, there was still a little part of me that was just a kid who just wanted a mum. And I searched for her, and God incident, somebody, one of the other women in the unit's mums managed, she must have been like Inspector Clouseau, but she managed to track her down. And my mum said she didn't want to know. And, like, I'd worked a step three at that time. And I really thought I knew what step three was about. Until I was asked to either respect her wishes or not. And to go with God's will or mine. And to do this thing despite all the feelings that came up. And despite not understanding why on earth. Where's my dream? Where's my happy ending? You guys all get it. What is it I'm not doing that means I'm not getting that? You know, and that's where step three really came into play for me, because it was like, I don't get this. I don't understand it. I don't agree with it. In fact, I hate it. But I'm going to respect it anyway and just trust that somehow, some way, somewhere along the line, this is going to make sense to me. I get released and I go to this other place. And again, you know, I sanctimonious, self-righteous, self-centered, you know, I was a year clean. Like, I'm not quite sure what these 30-day people here have got to teach me, but I'll impart some of my superior knowledge and wisdom if they should need it. And I didn't think that I was going to make any of the mistakes that they did. You know, like the relationship mistakes, but never me. And the reality is I did, you know, and I just, you know, those series of humbling events that occur, you know, those ones that feel awful, but in the end you kind of look back and go, thank God that happened, like, thank God someone burst my bubble. And what happened is this, the lesson was this: honesty breeds feeling clean on the inside. I didn't know that until I stopped being honest. And I started to feel dirty on the inside again. It wasn't about clean time. Clean time was irrelevant. I felt like her on the street corner again, clean. And I started to hold things for lots of people. And then I decided to have a purge. I'm going to have a purge. So I went and found this counsellor woman. And I told her everything that everyone else had done. And left. And then it kind of, you know, I'd gone in there with really good intentions, and then I went back the next day and I said, and here's the other bit, here's the most important bit. And the issue with that was, like, she trusted me and I'd betrayed her trust. Like, she'd gone and fought my, because I'm a good liar, I didn't come on top, I didn't. She'd fought my corner with other people who were saying, they're in a relationship. That she was like, no. And, like, actually feeling clean, what it feels like to disappoint somebody who trusts you like that, it was powerful. It was powerful. And but at the same time, I felt clean on the inside again. I felt like, a step four and five process can feel like where you've just cleaned everything out. You feel, like, whole and fresh. I felt like that. And it's a good job I did. Because I got called into the office a few weeks later and to be told that my mum had died. And, like, it wasn't her physical death that affected me. It was the death of the dream. Do you know that little girl dream? It was the death of that. But I tell you what I did do. I went to a meeting. We were lucky. We got tucked to meetings all the time. And I went to a meeting and I let Narcotics Anonymous hold me through it. And somehow, some way, like, I learned what no matter what meant. Because what I figured was that, like, the worst possible thing I could do to her memory right now is use. And what it bred in me is, I want to break the legacy of addiction in my family. The only way I'm going to do that is here. This is it for me. I don't go anywhere else, I don't do anything else. It's here. I got myself a sponsor lined up, and the second I got out of there, I got busy. You know, I've consistently worked steps in the years that I've been around. I've consistently done service in the years that I've been around. I've consistently attended meetings, and I've consistently engaged with sponsorship. I don't have, like, a secret formula that you don't hear in every other share. I just do what my predecessors have done. That's it. And, you know, and it's been a wonderful and a terrible journey all in kind of one go. Like, I didn't realise, like, how ingrained some of those walls were. Like, I can create illusions of in-depth relationships and connectedness, and it, for me, it's surface. I'm not giving you anything, because the reality is, you know, Kieran talked about fear. It's terror. Let's talk about terror. I am terrified that you're going to hurt me. I'm terrified that you're going to turn into my mum. That's what I'm terrified of. And I'm also terrified of being found out. I'm terrified that I'm somehow, like, I'm worse than the rest of you. That I'm that bit more, and not in, like, a self-piteous way either, but I'm just that bit more broken, and there's that bit less hope for me. And that somehow, some way, someone's going to come into my life one day and go, "Haha, we were joking, off you pop." And so the lengths that, you know, this illness, what the disease of addiction does is, like, it now dresses up defects as spiritual principles. So I don't, you know, I believe I'm being helpful or kind or blah, blah, blah. And I'm not. I'm just trying to keep you over there so you don't see me. I don't want you to see me. I'm scared to see me. I meet me in step work, you know. And like, even now, I'm on the ninth step again. And having written my eighth step harms, you know, I'm not plagued by the idea I should know better, that question in step one. I'm not plagued by the idea that I should know better, but I do think I should do better. So writing those harms, and, like, the longest harms on there are to my two mates over there, the two women I love more than anybody else in the whole world. And seeing that and getting connected with the shame of that was awful. It was horrible. Because I don't want to be her. But I don't know how to not be her unless I come here. That's the reality. Like, the speed that I reconnect to those old parts of me is, it, you know, it's unbelievable. I see it now. You know, if I ever go and do H&I in a prison or anything like that, my walk changes, my talk changes, my whole demeanor changes immediately, because I'm in fear. Because I'm frightened. So I know how to deal with it. I know how to adapt to this. I know how to survive this situation. And then I realised that, actually, in all honesty, I couldn't survive prison now. I couldn't. My heart is far too old. I'd be just a wimp. I would. A total wimp. I'd just have to stay in my cell and lock the door. Because what this fellowship has done is it's restored, and it's restoring me. Like, all the time. I'm still doing the work now. There's so much more to do. I'm in a transitional phase now in my recovery where I'm trying to lose living in my identity as just the survivor. I'm more than a survivor. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have a life now. I have a life. I have a job. I have a partner. I'm in a relationship, you know, that I've been in. And I'm blessed. He's a good man that I've been in for years. You know, I'm a step parent now. I'm more than just the girl from the street corner who somehow survived that stuff, but I don't know how to live in her identity yet. You know, that healing process is still occurring. And it's more okay now than it's ever been. And I'm working on different things. You know, I'm going through a physical recovery at the moment. I thought that it was okay to eat everything that I wanted to eat, as long as I had acceptance around it. I just had to get accepted. I didn't have to stop eating, just get acceptance. And like, what I'm learning is this, is it's like, it's no more okay to poison my physical body now than it was to poison my physical body then. I just do it with a different thing, you know, and that hole in the soul, that spiritual void that we talk about here, like coming into this meeting tonight and looking out and seeing like the years of clean time, the hope, the possibilities and all of that stuff, that fills it. That absolutely fills it. Do you know what I mean? And seeing the other end of the spectrum outside when I went out for a cigarette, you know, those homeless guys sat out there, like, I hope that that never stops touching me. I hope that I never forget that I am only a use-up away. You know, because I have a progressive illness, progressive, incurable, fatal, which means that that's my first stop, not my last stop. Now, that's scary, but, this illness can still get me like that. Every so often, I'll be driving in my car somewhere, and I shouldn't do long journeys on my own. It's not actually good. And I decide that, hate my life, hate my job, hate my friends, hate my partner, hate my house. I'm just going to go to some random place and get drunk and just piss it all up against the wall. Like, sometimes it feels like too much. And other times, I look around my life and just think, I don't know what I ever did to deserve this, but I am so glad that I did it. Now, the only place that keeps me connected with all of that stuff and heals me enough to live in this world without being the junkie's kid is Narcotics Anonymous. That's it. That's it for me. That's where I belong. You don't have to be my parent. I'm not looking for that anymore. But here, like, you guys are the family that I never had. And you see me. And it's okay when you see me. It's okay for me to sit here and go, boom, this is me. I'm not frightened of that anymore. You know, this, I can't, there's no words. I cannot do justice for, you know, I can't find the words for what this fellowship does. But it... You know, they say freedom ain't free. Those four things, that's it. That's how. I didn't do anything special or wonderful or different. I don't deserve this any more than anybody else. I came here and I love this saying, I didn't tell the help how to help. I came and I listened to those that had come before me, and that doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes. I make millions. And I tend to, like, I don't do lots of little ones now. I save them and do whoppers. But it's okay. It's like, I survived them. I've learned to say sorry. I apparently don't like to say sorry so much, but I've learned to, and I can humble myself. I can be me, you know, and that's the gift of this fellowship. And if you want that, do what I did, and I'll leave it there.